Hello, everyone, again, and thank you for joining today's call, the eighth in our Solutions 2020 series featuring candidates for president and other policymakers likely to shape the 2020 race. We're thrilled to have Montana Governor Steve Bullock with us today. I'm Ed Meyer, partnering with Business Forward on our Solutions 2020 program, and I'll be moderating the conversation. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. Governor Bullock is the two-term governor and former Attorney General of Montana. During his time as governor, he expanded Medicaid, made investments in public education, passed infrastructure, signed an executive order protecting net neutrality in Montana, and has blocked every attack made on women's health care. We asked Governor Bullock to talk briefly about what he would do to support small businesses to boost our economy if elected president, but we're leaving the bulk of our time for you to ask questions and make recommendations. Before I get started, just a couple of housekeeping notes. You can participate in two ways. You can email a question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and we'll read it aloud. And you can also press 1 on your dial pad at any time to be entered into a queue to ask your question live. We'll get to as many of these as we can in the time we have. Please note that this call is on the record, and there may be reporters present. Governor Bullock, thank you for joining us today, and please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Ed, and thank all of you for joining. And also thanks for your active engagement, all of you at Business Forward in, as you call it, Solutions 2020, looking at where we need to go. When I first became governor, I actually put together what I call the Main Street Montana Project, saying that if a business was looking at coming to Montana or expanding, they'd want to assess its strengths and weaknesses and sort of where the opportunities are. And we wanted to put together a business plan for the state. But rather than having me do it, actually tapped into it. First, it was two of our leading CEOs in the state. By the end of it, we had about 250 what would be C-level business leaders, sector by sector, saying, how do we actually move this state forward? And I think that, I mean, my lessons, I think we ended up with about 150 deliverables out of that. My lessons that I learned early on as governor and would carry forward is that when we want to look at opportunities for growing our economy or investing in our educational system or preserving our quality of life, that government shouldn't be doing that alone. It should actually be in partnership with business as well as labor and other partners. Real quick, a little bit on my background, some of the challenges I see, what I'm hearing on the campaign trail. That said, in my second term as governor, served as attorney general before that, raised single-parent household here in Montana, paycheck to paycheck, only knew there was a governor's house in town because I'd lived in newspapers too as a kid, so I've made about 4 blocks in life. I worked my way through college, borrowed my way through law school. My wife and I paid off about $175,000 of law school loans, and then we returned back to Montana to raise our family here. You know, I think as we look at sort of the challenges that lay ahead of us both electorally and then as we move forward, you got to recognize when, you know, when I was growing up in the early 70s, 90% of 30-year-olds were doing better than their parents were at age 30. Today it's only half. Or about 60% of people that in real terms haven't had a pay increase in about 40 years, or two-thirds of this county's in the country have lost businesses over the last decade. Folks saying, you know, I shouldn't have to leave my community or my school or my church just to make a decent living. So when the economy's not working for everybody and they look to the political system and it's really captured now in this post-Citizens United world where what seems to get passed in D.C. is more about what the donors want than real reflective. I think that's where the frustration lies. And that's everything from, you know, when Lindsey Graham says we have to get this tax cut through to make our donors happy and 40% of Americans wouldn't have $400 in their pocket, or you're not even having a meaningful discussion by Republicans about climate change anymore. And I think in part that's on the outside money, or we can negotiate prescription drug costs. The economy's not working for people and the political system's not working. And that's why folks are anxious and angry and divided, and Donald Trump's capitalized on that and actually poured gasoline on that fire from my perspective. So we've got to win this election, but we also got to make sure that the economy and the political system works for all of us. And 2016, I was the only Democrat in the country to get reelected in a state where Trump won. He took Montana by 20 points. I won by 4. 25 to 30% of my voters voted for Donald Trump. And politically, if we're going to actually win this election, I mean, the path to victory doesn't just go through the coast. It goes through the Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, states where we had Obama-Trump voters that are no longer with us. And I think that part of that is we got to be able to make a connection to people's everyday lives. And it's been interesting. In some respects, I guess I got in late because I was my legislature was still meeting, had to get healthcare reauthorized. But I think I've made a dozen trips, about 60-some visits to meet and greets in Iowa alone. And many of the things that you hear about at the national level, impeachment, the like, that's not what folks are talking about. I mean, they're talking about with 20% of rural hospitals at risk of closing, worrying about what are we going to do to keep these hospitals open. They're worried about being able to climb a career ladder or have educational opportunities. And as Democrats, I think we got to make sure that we can't become disconnected from sort of the everyday challenges people are facing, or we're not going to win this election. And I think especially there and other places, though, that, you know, we've seen the impact of Trump sort of America first becoming America alone. Trade policies have been significant in as much as that people are losing hundreds of thousands of dollars and they don't want to just rely on payments from the USDA. Or they look at the tax policies where they're not really helping any working folks. Or they look at trade policies where it hasn't fundamentally sort of changed, you know, sort of what was promised hasn't been delivered. And they don't see a path forward. And, you know, I mean, I've said what's gone up since he took office, the number of uninsured, federal deficit, certainly hate crimes, but in real terms, not that much when it comes to wages and actual employment. So I think that we have to take a look at a more reasoned approach going forward, a thoughtful that everyone feels like they can have a participation. And it's not going to be all about, in part, at least from my perspective, there's some times where Democrats are talking and it seems a little bit detached from everybody's life. Like, look, we got to deal with college affordability and we have to deal with the challenges of student debt. But when 68% of people don't even have a two-year degree, that's an area of disconnect. We have to make sure that everyone has access to affordable health care. And I think we can do that with a public option, negotiating prescription drug prices, surprise medical billing and out-of-network charges. But to completely throw out all the gains made under the Affordable Care Act and start over and disrupt the lives of about 165 million people on employer-sponsored health care doesn't seem to me like the right direction, both from a policy perspective and also winning this election. I touch briefly on what's been kind of the fight of my career in some respects, and then I'll open up for questions. I think if we don't deal with sort of this post-Citizens United world where money is speech and corporations are people, and look at what it's done to our overall system, it's going to be that much harder to make any of the gains that are talked about regularly, at least among the Democrat primary. As AG, when Citizens United came up, then took the first case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court after Citizens United, then even with because my legislature is about two-thirds Republican, we've been able to get meaningful things done. But even with that legislature, passed a law kicking dark money out of our elections. So it really is about more about the individual candidates and the voters and the outside spending. But if you look at from climate to drug prices, to income inequality, to gun safety, so many of those issues can be tied back to the corrupting influence of money in our system and how it's changed even the last decade. Got some plans for that I'd be happy to talk about, as well as anything else along the way. I think as I'll close, looking forward, I think that people want government to work. They don't want the degrees of division. I think they want a grown-up. And to try to believe the government can play a positive role in impacting your economic lives and work for the people that elect them. And my experience, my whole time I've been in government, I've dealt with a divided legislature. Now it's about 60% Republican. That's the best it's ever been. And we've been able to get meaningful things done, from health care to kicking dark money out of our elections, having the fourth lowest tuition fees in the nation, to really incentivizing apprenticeships and the professional certificates. And we've kept a fair tax climate. Been able to do that by trying to find common ground, but that doesn't mean you have to compromise your values. Also have more vetoes than any governor in the history of our state, and that's been everything from environmental degradation to taking away a woman's right to make their own health care decisions to ballot access. And I think that government can actually work, and it doesn't have to be sort of in the level of exhaustion that we have now. So I'll stop at that point, because I think, as Ed said, probably more engaging than listening to me would be responding to some of the questions that you all might have.
Thank you, Governor. Really, really appreciate it. If folks want to speak live, you can press 1. And if you want to email a question, you can email it at info@businessfwd.org, a question for Governor Bullock. And we do already have several questions that have come in, Governor. And one of the, you highlighted your track record on finding common ground without compromising values. And you also spoke about, we can't just win from working from the coasts. And we've got several questions about that, just that, about bipartisanship and your impressive track record and working across the aisle. I'll highlight just a couple, and we'd love for you to talk a little further about it. John Delabos in Nevada asked, how would you go about fostering the level of bipartisanship that exists in Montana? How would you do that in Washington? And Ellen Schaffer from San Francisco, so an email from the coast here, is asking, how were you able to overcome Republican opposition to expanding Medicaid? So both of those questions focusing on the secret sauce, I guess, of how you've done that in Montana and how you could take that to Washington.
You bet. Thanks, Ed. Yeah, and so when we got Medicaid expansion passed the first time, it was in 2015, sort of the heart of the anti-Obamacare time. Real quick story, I never forget. Went to a town called Shoto, Montana. It's about 1,700 people on the Rocky Mountain front. Literally everyone in town knew why I was coming, because Americans for Prosperity had sent everyone in town these mailers with Barack Obama and my face on it, saying Bullock and Obama are coming to your community to destroy your health care system. But instead of just like going into a very Republican district and telling them what they needed, I listened. And first person that spoke was hospital administrators. Said 43% of people that walk through these hospital doors don't have health insurance. A couple people got up afterwards, called me a communist or this and that. And probably the fifth speaker was the head of the county commissioner. He was a rancher, wasn't even from Shoto. He's from a small town called Bynum. And he got up and he said, I was born in this hospital, and this hospital saved my life 2 years ago when I had a heart attack. And folks, if we lose this hospital, this town's gone. So by actually showing up, and I did probably 10 or 15 of those, I took the politics out of it by letting people talk to me as opposed to me saying, this is coming from D.C. And I typically begin with the base assumption that most folks' lives are too frantic or busy or hectic to care about politics, but the values people have are, you want a safe community, you want a decent job, you want clean air, clean water, roof over your head, good public schools, and the belief you can do better for your kids and grandkids and yourself. So I always framed that in those values. And that, I think, is in some ways how I've been able to find a lot of common ground to get things done. And I get that D.C. seems completely broken in that respect. But I think that you also have to be making your case not just in D.C., but actually to America. Like, yeah, I try to build good relationships with Republican legislators in my state house, but I don't rely on those relationships alone. Like, I'm all throughout this 147,000 square mile state to try to put pressure on getting local legislators to do right. And I think that's something that the next president should probably be making his case. You know, if Mitch McConnell's still majority leader, spend as much time as Kentucky as they are anywhere else, because when you can get actual constituents to be making the noise, and folks like you all on this call, business people, to say, you have an expectation that government ought to work and work for us, then I think that you can make some fundamental change. Now, we also have to find ways, like anybody that says they're just going to govern by executive order, it's concerning in as much as that then we're just going to be in this whipsaw of everything getting rolled back, you know, within the next 4 or 8 years again. So I think that we do have to find, I do have to as a governor, I compromise. I don't compromise my values, but I find things where we can actually all get a little bit out of things to move things forward. And I do believe that that's still possible in Washington, D.C. with both the right person and the right mindset.
Thank you, Governor. We've got several questions around skills training and concerns around automation and what plans you would have at the federal government. I'll read one from Jim Morris. He's specifically asking, what are your plans for improving skills and income and wages for rural Americans? And we'd love to hear your perspective on that, especially with your experience in Montana.
Yeah, and thanks, Jim. And I also just got done with being chair of the National Governors Association, the Democrats and Republicans. And my year-long initiative is called Good Jobs for All Americans. And it looked in three different baskets. One, how are we training people up for the jobs of today? What do we do with the mid-career displaced worker due to automation, trade, or other things? And then what do we do with the urban-rural divide? And we had a number of workshops. That overall, the policy side of that, I think it's on the National Governors Association website of sort of what we all came up with as our nation's governors. But I think we have to, from the beginning, start taking a different look at both how we are training people. I mentioned, there's only about 32% of people that even have a two-year degree, yet we know a high school degree is not enough. And as pleased as I am that, like a frozen college tuition in Montana, we have the fourth lowest tuition fees in the nation, equally pleased that we've really made our two-year colleges not even about associate's degree, but about professionally recognized certificates and apprenticeships, things where people can actually make a decent living while they're climbing that ladder of opportunity. And people have climbed to the middle class in Montana at a rate higher than any other state in the country. And we have to, as a country, and led from certainly the presidency and the U.S. Department of Labor, revisit how we're training people from the get-go, because not everybody's going to go to college. And a lot of the jobs that are really in demand are a skills-based where you could, there's over 1,000 different apprenticeable fields. The direct urban to rural disconnect is often a little bit more challenging, to be honest. And, we've done things recognizing that a new employer in a small town of 8 is bigger than and more significant than an employer of 80 or 800 in a large town. We've tried to create the opportunities for that to occur, both some with state policies. I've put out an overall infrastructure plan where rural connectivity, we have to get to that point. You're not going to have a viable community. And on my website, stevebullock.com, I've put together an overall rural plan that you might want to take a look at. You're not going to have a viable community if you don't have access to quality health care as well. So I think that we have to incentivize both providers coming to those areas, but also from a rate and fee structure, ways to keep those rural hospitals open. And we've got to be able to make the connections between our smaller towns, our more rural areas, and the urban areas with both employers and skills training along the way. We've been able to do a good chunk of that in Montana. Between the rural plan at stevebullock.com and the NGA guide that we put together, I think there's quite a bit more that you can see, at least my thinking on that.
Excellent. Thank you, Governor. Well, hope a lot of business forward network folks go to the website and check out those plans. Another issue that is we're getting a lot of questions on is around trade policy. And you highlighted that in your opening remarks about President Trump's trade policies and how they've not been helpful, especially for, I think, American farmers. And in the Democratic debate, we're hearing some criticism of President Trump's policies, but not as much in terms of the solutions and what we would do and what you would do, what the candidates would do on these. So Katie Merritt from Columbus, Ohio, is asking, what would your trade policy be?
Yeah, and I think, Katie and Ed, that, look, you got to begin with the base presumption, right, that we have 5% of the world's population, and we can't just build off barriers and say that our businesses and our workers are going to succeed if we cut off the relationships to the outside world. There's nothing better than a farmer in Montana that said to me, like, if we had to eat all the wheat that we produce in Montana, literally every living Montana would have to eat 40 loaves of bread a day. But we've always kind of gone from the presumption that, worker training and environmental protocols have been the stepchild, the forgotten stepchild to trade deals. Capital can easily move across national borders, but workers can't. And at the same time that when the U.S. is paid about, and we spend about 20% on trade adjustment assistance, so helping out workers displaced by trade deals, is any European country. So then going forward, I am heartened that the discussion, the debate has said that when we're looking at, and this is what I would do as president, when I'm looking at a trade deal, that I'm also going to be looking at both labor protocols, environmental protocols along the way, and that they have to be part of the consideration in entering any trade agreement. Because if not, I think we're really, really going to be missing something along the way, and we're going to see further displacement. I think that, like, when we look at USMCA, which has a big impact in a state like mine, I mean, that was negotiated before even the internet was a driving force in commerce. So, yeah, we should be reexamining these trade deals, but we can't completely forget about the overall impacts. Certainly, companies' bottom lines can be significantly enhanced, but if we're not thinking about what the worker impacts are, and if we're not having environmental expectations, we're really, from my perspective, missing the boat. One thing that we've really seen with China, and now it's not just the farmers, is we're all getting hit, though, is that you can't expect to, like, get IP theft or coercion of IP taken away just by a blunt instrument of tariffs alone. And that's where this America First has really become America Alone. And in a post-World War II order where traditional allies had expectations of us, I think that's a real tenuous time right now. And there's going to have to be significant rebuilding done by this next administration to get us back to a place where we are doing much better in that respect.
Thank you, Governor. I think we're just about out of time, but I'm going to sort of take moderator's privilege and ask you one last question, if I can. A lot of folks in the network are focused on the gender pay gap and how we can work to end the pay gap. And I know in Montana you have launched or announced the Equal Pay for Equal Work Task Force, and would love for you to talk a little more about that and how you would prioritize closing the pay gap from the White House.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, and it's something I've been working on for 6 years. To think that almost 6 years after Congress passed the Equal Pay Act, women still making 80 cents on the dollar compared to men, I think that there are a number of different things you can do, one of which is even at a base level of training. So I've changed the way that both at my job services and my universities that women are, and men at times, though, are trained to negotiate for salaries, because more often than not, they're unwilling to really have those basic skills to ask what they should be worth. We need to ensure that businesses are playing a role. I mean, I have probably about 300 businesses in the state of Montana now that agreed to and often even have put a sticker up in the window saying that they will agree to base principles. It's on them or my state government website of what those principles are of equal pay for equal work. And that's everything from a beginning, trying to prohibit, and I think as president, I'd push for a law to prevent employers from asking applicants about the previous salary so that those inequities aren't following women from job to job. We've done pay audits throughout state government, and we need to work with businesses to incentivize payroll audits to identify and correct gender pay disparities. We need to make sure that there's a base transparency that an employee can't be disciplined for asking what other employees make, because that sort of institutionalizes gender pay disparities. And I think we also have to have paid family leave if we're ever going to get to the point where the gender pay gap is really met. And right now, one in four mothers return to work within 10 days of giving birth, and rates even higher among women of color in low-income communities. And getting to the point where we have, you know, a dozen weeks of paid leave could not only substantially impact those families, but also help address some of the inherent challenges that women often face in the workplace. 60 years after Equal Pay Act, when we're still 80 cents on the dollar, we have a ways to go with transparency, with actually having businesses at the table as leaders, and with getting rid of some of the sort of challenging laws that make that transparency unavailable. I think we could make meaningful gains.
Well, there's thousands of business leaders here in this network that are focused and dedicated to closing that pay gap as well. So they will be big, good partners in that effort. So thank you, Governor. Really appreciate it. And that's all the time that we have today. And I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please check your email for a survey that will come to you after this call, where you can let us know what you thought of today's call. If you missed any part of this, or you would like to share it with other business leaders, you can visit the Business Forward website at businessfwd.org to listen to a podcast and read a recap of today's call. The podcast is available on Spotify, iTunes, and Google Play. Again, thank you to Governor Bullock and everyone who joined today's call. We'll look forward to connecting again soon. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks all of you for joining us as well.